Conquer the Noise is a podcast produced by Unconquered, an independent agency challenging brand perspective to redefine content. This podcast is dedicated to telling stories of outstanding ideas and people who have found their way amongst the chatter.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us on this week's episode of Conquer the Noise. I'm your host, Jonathan Hansen. We're speaking with Merv Iden. Obviously, I'm recording this again from our my New York City apartment. You can probably hear the sirens going off in the background. But wait, it's more authentic that way, right? So Merv Iden, she's the founder of Elomaya, a Turkish olive oil brand. Her family's been making olive oil for generations in the southwest region of Turkey. And what she basically did is she joined up with the other local farmers in the region and started creating a premium organic olive oil that, one, honors the cultural significance of the region, but also I think is a testament to keeping business within the communities and creating living wages and helping local communities thrive. I'm really excited to talk to her today. I love olive oil, I love cooking, and I'm excited to see how she's working out of Turkey on a brand inside the United States. I think it's going to be a really interesting conversation. Merv, thank you so much for joining us. So Merv, thank you so much for joining us today. Where are you calling from?
I'm actually in Boston right now, a little north of Boston.
And is that your home base?
Yes, we are.
So how have you been running, or how has it been running a olive oil company that has roots in Turkey? You're in the cold Arctic Boston area. How's it going? How are you doing that? How are you managing that?
That is actually a pretty good question, because I was actually back in Turkey. I spent the entire summer basically in Turkey. Uh-huh. And the day I came back at the end of August, it was a completely change of weather and everything. So beautiful weather in Turkey and, as I said, Arctic weather in Boston. But so I'm fortunate enough, I'm based in Boston in the U.S. However, my business partners, my brother and my father, they are based in my hometown, Turkey, where this business actually operates in terms of production, you know, research and development, and some of the marketing pieces as well. So that's how we are being successful.
And, you know, because you're from Turkey, and I don't think I would say the average U.S. citizen probably doesn't have a whole lot of context around Turkey, or maybe hasn't traveled that. I haven't met a lot of people that have traveled there outside of a few close friends. What is one thing, before we jump into what the heart of your business, what is one thing that you would like people to know who've never been to Turkey or unfamiliar with the country? As someone who's lived there, obviously has very close personal ties to it, both from a passion side for what it can produce and offer the world, but also just from the place of origin.
So the first thing I usually ask is, what kind of language do we speak? If we speak Arabic or if we speak any other languages? This is one thing that, you know, people ask, and we speak Turkish. But the second thing they usually ask, if the people are friendly. I don't know where the concept of unfriendly comes from. But the people in Turkey, we are very similar. We are Mediterranean culture. So we are very similar to Italians, Greeks, and Spanish. Very friendly. We love hosting in our households. You know, we love people coming into our homes for dinners. And, you know, we set dinners for hours. So it's the first two things that I'm usually asked, and I have to explain myself, I guess, for my culture.
My sister just spent 3 weeks traveling through Turkey for her honeymoon. She got back last week and is in love with the country and her experience there, and has been like, every time I talk to her, she's still pulling from the energy of her trip, trying to recruit me to go on a trip with her next year there, and just had wonderful things to say about it. And I think really match up to what you're saying. She said people were so friendly and welcoming and really eager to show them like a true authentic experience there. The food, she said, was amazing. I think breakfast was her favorite thing there, which is one of the things I was very surprised for her, knowing my sister, to say.
Called Turkish breakfast, and it is a feast. And since we got back, this is about 2.5 weeks has been, my kids have been asking Turkish breakfast every single morning.
So what is that? What's the difference? What would you say the difference is between like between a Turkish breakfast and?
So to be honest with you, in the US, it's just like breakfast, eat and go.
Yeah.
Cereal, pancake or, you know, stuff like that. In Turkey, you basically sit on the breakfast for hours.
Mm-hmm.
You have 5 or 6 different of cheeses, 3 or 4 different of different olives, tomatoes, cucumbers, a bunch of different of jams and honey, like everything that you can think of.
Mm-hmm.
Different bread. And you, it's just like you basically enjoy eating. And when you're eating there, you're so mindfully eating rather than eating and, you know, yep, on the go. So I think that's the difference.
Yeah, she brought back a bunch of jams for our family. Which I'm really excited to try.
And next time, either she or you go, hit me up. Make sure
definitely.
You guys
hit me up. Definitely.
Yeah, if I'm not there, my brother is there, my dad is there. So we will make sure you guys are.
Amazing.
Be sure part of our culture too. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for that, Alfar. It's really, thanks, really so sweet. You know, I'm curious to how now, so we have a little bit of background on some of the Turkish culture a little bit. I would love to hear how you're sort of, no pun intended, infusing this into your olive oil business and story, and how you're bringing this into the U.S. market.
So, Aleamea, we founded Aleamea with my brother and myself. We basically started dreaming about this back in 2006, both of us. And I was in college at the time, and he was in high school. My father supported us from day one. And I mean, it's me and my brother, we founded it, but my dad and my mom are definitely involved in many different levels as well. And we produce, it's a USDA organic, but the organic certification is also valid in Turkey and in European Union countries.
Mm-hmm.
Extra virgin olive oils. And it's, to better describe where in Turkey, it's the southwest region of Turkey. So we are not on the coast, but the closest coastline is the Aegean Sea part of Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
This goes back for, you know, years. Our family, my grandfather's father, has been producing olive oil in this same region.
Mm-hmm.
For generations. So we never commercialize it. We never sell it. It was always gifting to our, you know, visitors, gifting, mm-hmm, to our friends, family. But we saw a gap. We saw a gap in organic farming practices in Turkey and development, mm-hmm, in Turkey. And this happened back in 2004 that my dad decided to invest significantly in developing that infrastructure through our local partnerships. So in our region only, which is a very small region, there's only maybe 1,000 farmers, olive farmers.
Mm-hmm.
But the olive and olive industry in Turkey is so much humongous than this. So now with our foundation, we were able to connect with, right now it's over 800 farmers, over about 14,000 acres of lands. We were able to get these farmers organic certified, educated, and basically help them better understand how they can sustainably keep their farms and move forward to the next generations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that seems like a really big undertaking, as far as like the educational process, sort of creating this community and getting everyone to come together. I'm curious what that process was like for you all to develop that educational network and that the process of like, were you doing meetings? Were you doing like a sort of a school? What was that like to try and teach some of these newer practices?
So at the very beginning, when we first introduced this, it was a lot of education. I'm talking about back in mid-2000s, so 2004, uh-huh, 2005, 2006. A lot of in-person education, a lot of consulting, on-site visits, and we had engineers with us. We had experts in terms of sustainable and organic farming practices.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we started. But right now it's more like more on the consulting level. So when these farmers need help with any sort of, you know, if they have any questions, any sort of questions, they usually come to our foundation. And if we don't know the answer, we usually work with the government entities mm-hmm. that supports this, you know, development and get them the answer for them. So the farms, though, it's so that region, majority of the farms are on the uphills. So mm-hmm. think about mountains. Mm-hmm. So no modern machinery can go in there. You can't even go in there with your tractor or your car. You have to go there walking. So this is a perfect situation that can any that can a farmer could ask how to, you know, take my current situation to the next generations without damaging, just keeping it as is without damaging, and then moving to the next generations. That's, I think, you know, by just knowing that this is possible, they took these farms from their ancestors, yes, mm-hmm. but they didn't know how to, you know, give these farms to their grandkids as they are, I guess. So now they do. They just, you know, keep learning. They just need. They just keep practicing and then keep mm-hmm. moving forward.
Mm-hmm. And so, what I find really interesting for you is that, you know, looking at your background, this is definitely a new sort of career change for you. You know, you've spent your earlier part of your life in recruitment mm-hmm. and human resources. So I'm really curious, you know, what sparked this change and inspired you to get into this line of work? And how has that been as far as just a midlife career change?
So if you actually go all the way back, I got my undergrad with, my undergrad was business administration focused on finance and accounting. Mm-hmm. And I got my MBA and I actually decided to focus even more on finance. So I actually, my education background is finance and accounting. Mm-hmm. And then after I graduated, I was able to, at the time, it was still, the crisis was still going. This is back in 2011. Economic crisis was still, you know, hard. So I was able to find a job in human resources in DC, mm-hmm. working with government agencies. So that for me was perfect because that was my, you know, I was only here in the United States for a couple of years. I was going to be able to learn U.S. government and their entities. Mm-hmm. That's when I decided to take the leap of faith and join the human resources part of the sector. And then I stayed there, ended up loving it. And then, but I still had that dream of producing something or making something, being that producer, being that maker of a product that can be done if it is done correctly, if it is done sustainably, if it is done organically, that it doesn't have to be cost, you know, it doesn't have to cost the customers thousands of bucks to, you know, to access it. Mm-hmm. So it was always in my mind to come up with an accessible product. And although it was perfect because, again, my four generations, my grandfather's father, they produce olive oil. So that was one thing that I was very excited to take the leap again, you know, mid-career. And so we can, because I know that I could passionately stay involved in every step of the production process. Mm-hmm. Like I can be involved in the cultivation, I could be involved in the harvesting, I could be involved with the farmers, I could be involved in every step of the production so that I see and I can control how I can control the steps in the sustainable business, basically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so how's it been like adjusting? Has there been like a big learning curve for you? Is it something that, you know, it's obviously been your family for a long time, so I'm sure there's already a strong level of base knowledge, but then you have also the issues of importing into the United States. You know, I'm curious how all that's been, how you've navigated all that. That seems
really daunting and difficult.
Yeah, so that's a whole different, you know, topic, I believe. But yeah, we are, you know, it's, I am a person, I'm very much motivated by innovation, like constantly, like entrepreneurial thinking and like trying to create new products. So the move wasn't that difficult because I'm always in a constant mind of like thinking. Mm-hmm. But when it becomes reality, that's when it becomes, you know, when it hits the reality heads, that's when it comes, you know. So we wanted to source recyclable bottles, that we want to make sure our bottles are recycled. We want to make sure the products stay as fresh as the day we basically produced the product. So we need to source a special cap. And I want to make sure that's also recyclable. And then we decide, you know, we were looking for the you know, the importing, you mentioned. So we were like looking companies in the US to work with, but then that was adding extra cost. And then that was increasing the us and increasing the R&D cost, which is not what I meant. I want to have an accessible product in terms of price point. So we actually gathered everything. All of our team is actually right now still in Turkey. Our importers are in Turkey. It's a Turkish company that helps us import everything here, that handles the documents in the US, and then we just pull the documents and then distribute it in the United States, basically.
Okay, interesting. Very interesting. So olive oil is one of those things where, you know, I go to the grocery store and there's just like so many options, probably 20, 30 options or so. And they range from like really cheap to sometimes kind of expensive. Obviously expensive is relative to who's standing in front of the price tag, but could be up to, I've seen them up to $40 or so.
Oh yeah.
And yours kind of sits in the middle in some ways, or at least of the spectrum that I just listed out. I'm curious to like, it seems really hard for me to understand how you sort of position yourself within that sort of diversity of price ranges, and then how you can communicate why it's there. Because I think sometimes I'm reading, you know, I'll be sitting in the grocery store and I'm reading, I'm trying to understand why one costs so much more than the other. What are the benefits versus the other? How do I taste the benefits? There's all these things that I'm thinking through this. And I think this is a great opportunity right now to just to talk through that and just, I think, help our own listeners become a little bit more educated in what they should be considering or thinking through when they're buying. So
yeah,
I would love to talk through some of that. Yeah.
It's a great question. I'm going to try to be as politically correct as possible too. Like,
it's okay,
I don't
want
to say, I don't want to say they're too expensive. I don't. So this is what we are doing, basically. I grew up without consuming a sip of store-bought olive oil.
Yeah.
But when I moved to U.S., well, I actually lived in Milan for 6 months as an exchange student. Over there, it's a whole different, you know, concept of olive oil. But I found myself in the U.S. Why the quality didn't meet my expectation with every single bottle, basically, I had to buy from different retail stores. Mm-hmm. I tried, as you said, one of the most expensive ones to the cheapest one in the store. But so we are working with the farmers and we are buying their olives as an early harvest olives. This actually increased the pricing of the olive. We are not buying their oils. We are actually squeezing the oil in our own facility. We are buying their oil, the olives from their farm. We hand, you know, harvest them together. We bring them to our facility. So we control everything from, as mentioned, from our farmers to the end products. This gives us to control the pricing as much as possible. From the tree to the bottle. After that, it's honestly try to keep, again, I don't know why those expensive olive oils are expensive, because with our price range, we can give an award-winning product with a great quality inside, extra virgin with great, lab test results, mm-hmm. with that kind of pricing. If this answered your, question.
No, I think it does. And I think I think part of that price that you're paying for some of these more expensive bottles is brand, right? Like it boils down to the brand and the story that people are buying into. And I think if you have beautiful packaging, if they're trying to sell a very specific angle of it, hand-picked, single sourced, whatever, it's all about the brand cachet and what's being communicated, which I think really opens itself up to thinking through. I'm curious to how you're differentiating yourself then, through your storytelling.
So we are, we are organically sourced. And like I mentioned in the very beginning, we are not only US, organic certified in the US, but in the European Union as well as Turkey. And cold press, but most importantly, with our works, with our foundation that we have been working together, the farmers, we are providing not just social, economic and social, development to these farmers as well. Mm-hmm. In the past, these farmers had to sell their oil, not olives, oil, which mm-hmm. is a lot cheaper than olives, to a government-run entity mm-hmm. In a very cheap price. And the pricing was determined by the government, not by the farmers. So we are. Mm-hmm. This is our story. Our story is we provide, with our foundation, we work with the farmers and provide them an economic and social freedom to decide and keep their farms as organic and sustainable possible and decide what they want to do with their farms, just basically. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think, part of that brand really is around name and developing a brand name. And I'm curious to how you landed on your name and what that means.
Oleamea?
Yeah.
It means in Latin, my olive. And when we were deciding on a brand name, there were a couple other Latin names, but it really resonated that this was, my part of, when I was growing up, consuming mm-hmm. olive oil, but it was my product. So I'm giving you, my customers, my product I'm serving what I can consume basically, mm-hmm. and I'm not serving what I will not use. Mm-hmm. That's where the brand name came from. Mm-hmm.
And so, there's olive oil from all different parts of the world. Going back to my sister, her husband's actually Tunisian, and his has a family farm with olive oil or olives, and they bring he makes their own olive oil and brings it back. So which I love. But I also love that story behind it. I think the story sometimes really makes things taste better. But I'm really curious to what the difference is between, Turkish olive oil versus Italian versus Tunisian. Is it more in the land? Is it more in the type of olive you're using?
Yeah. So there's so many different types of olive oil. This is what I will start saying. I think as long as the product is produced as sustainable and keeping the land as organic possible, mm-hmm. I think all the olive oil tastes great. Like I still try to keep tasting olive oils from Spain, Portugal, Croatia. They have mm-hmm. a beautiful olive oil. Mm-hmm. Tunisia. So we have a very different olive oil, the olive type in Turkey. It's mostly in my region. It's called Memecik. Mm-hmm. And it only grows in my region. And the fruitness of olive oil is medium fruity, but also the pungence and that beautiful smell of grass when you open the bottle will pop out of the bottle itself. That's the little nuances that is, gives the olive oil its characteristic or differentiation from mm-hmm. other olive oils. But again, as long as it is produced correctly in mm-hmm. my book, I think all the olive oil stays beautiful.
I think that's a great way to say it.
And I love how you're not taking like a elitist standpoint by saying Turkish olive oil is the best. I think it's really beautiful that you can acknowledge and say, you know, some people I think would definitely be a little biased in their opinion. I think you have a great perspective there.
I'm not going to, it's a Mediterranean culture. As I said, all the Mediterranean countries, they produce olive oil, they produce wine. I mean, you cannot just say, the Spanish wine is better than French wine. They have all their own characteristics. Yeah. Olive oil is actually very similar to the wine. And that's, I think, one of the, I know it took years to educate consumers about the different wines. It's going to probably take us to educate consumers about different olive oils. But if all the olive oils in my book is, if they're produced correctly, it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was doing quite a bit of research on the brand before our talk today. And, you know, your olive oils have made a lot of like top 10, top five lists online. And it seems like there's like a great strategy there of helping with brand validity there. It's, I think, one of the things when you're in a store and you're making a purchase, olive oil or wine, and I consider these two similar in some aspects just because of one, the varying price points, and then the regionality and the stories that go into telling how how it's being sold. I totally lost where I was going with that.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah, it's okay. So going back to that. So there's a strong, I think, element of having it be some of that risk de-risked by reading your product on a top 10, someone's validated it, said that this is great. So it's a little bit easier to make that purchase later on when you see the product, right?
For sure.
So I'm curious to, you know, how the rest of your marketing is stemming out of that. Are you primarily relying on like a PR strategy, or do you have a very strong, you know, social media strategy, or do you have like another way that you're trying to reach your customers?
Both. So going back to that, why we are being, you know, pushing on that forefront to be the best, one of the best olive oils.
Yeah.
There's so many, I want to say, junk in the market.
Mm-hmm.
And they are named, unfortunately, extra virgin olive oil, but majority of them aren't. I'm talking about the junk, basically. They're not even extra virgin olive oil quality. So that being, having that quality recognition as a top 10, top, five is very important to differentiate. It was very important to differentiate ourselves, because when, if you're in the market and if you're a consumer just looking at the pricing and determining if it is determining the quality, our price range, as you said, it lays in the middle. But in the meantime, this was our strategy. We want to create a really good quality product with an accessible pricing. So that was a very important part of the strategy to, you know, push that forefront to get quality recognized by international olive oil tasters. We have been in the competitions from Japan to Italy to United States, New York is the competition. So that was very important. So we work with, when we started working with our PR agency, that was one of the things that we wanted them to focus on. But we also want to make sure that they introduce the Turkish, you know, part of the culture of the brand as well, because everybody heard about Italian olive oils. Everybody heard about Greek olive oils. When I personally do, which I still keep doing, events with, you know, meeting with the customers, I always say, guess where the olive oil from? None of them ever said Turkey. Always said Portugal, Spain. But that was another thing, like Turkish olive oil has a great and quality olive oil. And that was one of the strategy that I'm pushing to educate the customer that Turkey has a great olive oil as well. Marketing strategy goes hand to hand with the PI as well. So they are, that's a couple of strategies that we are following right now.
And so is that, how do you translate that to like social media, right? Because so the nice thing with social media is it kind of offers you this two-way conversation. So I'm curious to how that's set, how you're setting it up and transferring that over to the social side.
So social media goes a little bit with this strategy, but also I wanted to focus on social media a little bit differently. Here's the reason. There are so many different oils in the market that consumers can basically cook. Good or bad is a different story. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to introduce in our social media strategy how consumers can use olive oil in their daily lives with their cooking, baking, with their, in their pasta sauce, or, they can make their hummus with it. So we are working with a team in Turkey who knows the cuisines all around the world. Mm-hmm. And they come up with, this was last year's strategy, but we are still continuing a bits of it. They basically create recipes using our olive oils, and we are basically using those in our social media strategy a little bit too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And
to teach. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, please continue.
So I just want to make sure the new generation is very eager to learn and eager to find out different ways. So we are targeting new generation as well with our social media strategy a little bit to, when they're cooking at home, they can use olive oil. It's not something that they should be scared of, basically.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. And I mean, since it's such a personal side or personal mm-hmm. business for you, and mm-hmm. I'm curious to how, how you're interjecting yourself into it. And if you're using, if you're appearing on social media, if you're using social media platforms to help with just your personal appearance and the brand, I've read statistically from some of our strategy work with other brands that, founders and CEOs who are often the face of the brand perform better with engagement on social media. And I'm curious if you're embracing that and using that as well.
I am. I think this comes with, I love my product and I'm so proud of it. So I think this shows too. That's why I'm not scared of showing my face. Yeah. I am behind this product. I'm behind this brand. Hamdi Ulukayas, the founder of Chobani, he had in one of his interviews, he said, let's produce products that we can, serve to our kids. So after I heard this, this is what I do. I like, mm-hmm. I don't produce anything that I won't serve to my kids. So mm-hmm. that's why I'm not scared of putting my face out there. Mm-hmm. We are actually working in a new project with completely different industry, still with, related to olive oil, but I'm not going to be scared of putting my face behind those parts because that's going to be very much hard work, but also that's something that I will be using on my daily life too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a great, great metric is, would you serve it to your family? Would you serve it to your children?
Yeah.
And speaking of family, your husband's involved in the business. This is a business that's been in your family for generations, or mm-hmm. or at least the olive portion of it. I don't know if it necessarily is a full on business, but at least the olive olive oil creation manufacturing. I'm curious to how you balance all that, because that's a lot of family time and work time at the same time. Yeah. So how are you balancing all that? How do you deal with all that?
To be honest with you, short answer is I'm not balancing it.
I think I love it. It's true and honest, and I love it.
Yeah. I mean, if I say that, it's a lie. I mean, long answer is that, I have two little kids. One is 2.5. The other is 5 years old. Mm-hmm. I have a business. I'm a business owner. I'm an entrepreneur. And, that has all these have different demands from me. Mm-hmm. And I think the worst part is these demands regularly change directions. Mm-hmm. One day you wake up, your kids ask to go to zoo, and then you have to take a 5 p.m. meeting, and then, you have a deadline for new projects, stuff like that. So it's just like for me, how to make it sustainable is to be okay with the changes mm-hmm. That comes to my way. and know that I only have, you know, a certain amount of time in a day where I can accomplish so much. Because if I start beating myself that I didn't answer to that email right there, right that moment, instead of when my kid is pulling my leg to play with them, you know, I just gonna be okay with that at that, at that time. So it's, yeah, I'm trying my best to balance it as much as possible, but short answer, no, I cannot balance it all the time.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, as a founder, it's something I struggle with too, is creating space. And then when I create the space, making sure I continue to be present and not thinking about, oh man, I gotta get back to this and I gotta do that, and just maintain the focus on what I'm actually doing and trying to enjoy. And, you know, sometimes I wonder if like that work-life balance, as much as I try to create it for our team and employees, but from a founder's perspective, you know, sometimes I wonder if that's just a fallacy and if it's something that's, that can actually be true. And one, you know, you maybe, you know, I also think I'm similar to your career in that, you know, I've had a sort of a later stage transition into something new. And I remember the first, you know, 10, 15 years of my career before this was just go, all the time. And I'm wondering, and sometimes I wonder, maybe that's the method. You go hard while you're young and you have the time and energy, and then taper off as you get older. But at the same time, going back to what I was saying earlier, it's still not the case. I still find myself trying to push. And it's just been something I personally have struggled with. And often wonder if you really can, you know, I think it's hard to taper motivation and inspiration sometimes to you know, open, keeping your life open to other opportunities and like as far as like a real life experience moment versus like creating a business. And my father was an entrepreneur and had his own business and my whole life. And then I think probably 10 years ago, I'll never forget it. We were just sitting around dinner, and we have long family dinners as well. And he said that one of his regrets when he was younger was not spending enough time with us. I always thought he was very present and very much involved in our lives. So it was interesting for him to say that, because I had never thought, oh, my dad didn't spend any time with me, because that was, in my opinion, it was never the case. But I think just hearing him say that, that was definitely one of those moments where you're like, I think he's been evaluating like where he spent his time and like where he, you know, chose to put some of his energy in. I think it, for the benefit of the family, it provided us with a lifestyle that, you know, made me very fortunate and got a lot of opportunity out of it. So I mean, I'm grateful for it. But it just has been in my mind as I get older and start thinking about, my life and how I'm going to, continue to like be a person outside of being a business owner. How you sort of try and merge those two. And it's something that's just, I think, difficult. And I think, you know, long-term, it makes you also wonder, like, where do I see this brand going? You know, especially as you start to think through, like, your commitment, what you're putting into it, what's the long-term version or vision of it? And I'm curious for you, you know, with all that said, what's your long-term vision for your business? Do you want this to be something you pass on to your children, or is this something that, you know, you're going to do for the time being and you're encouraging them to do their own thing? Or I would love to hear what you're thinking there.
So it's funny, because like probably all mom or dads will say, like, I want them to do whatever they are, you know, passionate about. This was my passion. I will never push that to them. But what I want to create in our region, and, you know, hopefully make it a little bit more wider than just our region in Turkey and maybe all Turkey, is to keep our lands as is. Our lands are already very nurturing. It's, you know, for centuries we had those. Some of our altars are, you know, thousands of years old. So they have been there, like, they're not going anywhere. Just don't damage them any further. So, you know, making this mindset as valuable to all the regions in Turkey as possible is what I'm going to try. If this continues via my kids, perfect. But I want to set up this mindset to keep this self-pushing for generations after us. That's one thing. With the olive oil, I'm going to be probably producing all the world until the end of my life. And mm-hmm. then I'm starting this new venture. It's a little bit on the different side. We are trying to come up with all natural. It's a little bit tricky to get the organic certification, but I'm still working on it. I'm not giving up on the idea of kids' cosmetic products, which is shampoo, you know, lotion mm-hmm. with an our extra virgin olive oil as an ingredient, main mm-hmm. ingredient. So mm-hmm. I'm working on that new venture. I have a couple other, you know, projects going on. So olive oil is a core, but I want to be, you know, spreading the arms a little bit into different areas of where can we, you know, bring the olive oil into the mixture and make it a better product, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that sets us up for like one of the last questions I wanted to run through as we approach time. You know, I've used olive oil in, you know, just personal care. And I'm curious to what a non-conventional use of olive oil is that you don't think a lot of people know of.
Well, I wish my dad was here because he would have answered that. My dad uses olive oil in everything. Like, yeah. He has never used a store-bought shampoo. He's 65 years old this year. He uses uh-huh. olive oil soap. He has an eczema, so he can't use any store-bought, you know, liquid soaps or anything. He uh-huh. uses olive oil soap. And as a lotion, he can't use, you know, any type of, he uses olive oil as a lotion. In his hands and his body. And then I use olive oil as a cradle crap remedy. You know, the babies when they're born, they have that, those little wipes. So it's a remedy for that. I use olive oil for diaper rash for my daughter. Solution.
Amazing.
Because it has antioxidants in it. So no one knows about this. Like, it has healing powers. Like, before centuries ago, seriously, we have documents that it was used as in everything, mm-hmm. every imaginable thing. So mm-hmm. we just forget about those, you mm-hmm. know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I saw on your website or your social media, olive oil and ice cream, which I am going to try.
Please do. But make sure. So it's going to depend on the olive oil you have, because, you can actually check the New York International Olive Oil Competitions website, because they have some recommendation depending on the olive oil. Some olive oils are really good with chocolate mm-hmm. and vanilla, and some olive oils are really great with fruity sorbet. Oh. So it's going to depend on the olive oil you have that you're going to be purchasing. It's a delicious way. Our olive oil goes really well with sorbets, like fruity.
Beautiful.
And it just depends, but yeah, delicious.
Awesome. I'm going to try it. Well, thank you so much for talking with us today. I really enjoyed the conversation, learning more about, you know, how you're building your brand and just the olive oil world. I think it's just one of those things it's kind of a mystery to folks. So I hope this provides some context and helps with their next purchase.
Yeah. Oh my God. Thank you so much for having me. I was thrilled, and I'm so happy to, you know, talk to you guys today.
All right. Thank you so much. We'll talk soon.
Thank you. Yeah. Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us this last hour. I hope you are feeling inspired and feeling like you learned something. Please head on over to the Apple Podcast app and leave a review. You're also welcome to email me, jay@weareunconquered.co. See you next week.